Hi, my name is Dennis Mayer. I did 19 years, 2 months, and 29 days in Massachusetts prison. I've been out for 14 years, and I'm a Patriots fan.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction and problems with the justice system. How are you doing this week, DeMarco?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. It was a very interesting week. I've did a lot of reading and studying, and I'm also looking for a new house. I'm trying to move.
What were you reading and studying?
Oh, I've been reading a little bit of everything. You know, I have a thing. I'm trying to learn technology. So I have a pamphlet on how to work my laptop, and I'm trying to learn how to work my laptop so I can, you know, with ease. I'm trying to get to studying this computer, this technology thing down.
Good for you. I have a trivia question for today. Today we're interviewing Dennis Mayer, who was wrongfully convicted in the state of Massachusetts. So today's trivia question is about the New England Innocence Project, which includes Massachusetts. Okay, are you ready for the question?
Yes, I am.
The New England Innocence Project serves the states of Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Vermont. So the question is, how many people have been exonerated from that area according to the exoneration registry? A, over 50, B, over 60, C, over 70, or D, over 80?
I'm going to go with D, over 80.
It's actually C, over 70. I got it from the New England Innocence Project's website, and it said over 70, so maybe it could be over 80 because it didn't say how many over 70. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
DeMarco, I'm so excited about our new sponsor. It's called FabFitFun, and that's the perfect name for it. It's not just one of those beauty sample boxes. It's a mix of full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products. The best part is it's delivered to the comfort of my home. 4 times a year. You know, I was thinking you'd mentioned that you wanted to get something special for your wife to show how much you appreciated her. You also struggle with time to actually, like, go out and go shopping. I think this might be your perfect solution.
I love my wife and I want to make sure she gets the perfect gift. What kind of things are in that box?
The first thing I noticed when I opened the box was a warm, cozy blanket that I love. I have to be honest, though. The necklace that I found next stole my heart. It was so pretty. There were some high-class skin products inside, and even a pair of aloe-infused socks. So, what do you think? Do you think this is something Brandy would be interested in?
Heck yeah. I mean, she would use all of those things, and I would look like a hero. There's just one thing. How much does it cost?
Well, she would get a box 4 times a year with over $200 worth of great things inside. Though it only costs you $49.99 a box. Plus, we have a promo code for $10 off your first box. So basically, you're getting a $200 value for only $39.99.
Okay. This is too good to pass up. How do I sign up?
Just go to fabfitfun.com. And you can get your discount and your FabFitFun box today.
Let me make sure I understand you. To get your FabFitFun box today? Hold on. I bet y'all can't say that 3 times. FabFitFun, FabFitFun, FabFitFun. Go to FabFitFun.com and use promo code ACTUAL to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 value for just $39.99. Again, go to FabFitFun.com and use our code ACTUAL to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
So, DeMarco was once again responsible for bringing us today's guest. DeMarco, can you tell us how you became acquainted with Dennis and Dennis's story?
Yes, through Facebook. I'm friends with a lot of exonerees, and someone had shared one of his posts, and from there, I was interested, intrigued by the post. I don't really recall what it was right off, and after I read it, then I read that Dennis was an exoneree, and I sent him a friend request, and that's how I became acquainted with Dennis.
So we're going to go ahead and play Dennis's interview for you.
Let's do it.
I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit, like, what was your life like growing up when you were young? What was your family like?
Yeah, we had rough times. You know, my father was an alcoholic and, you know, projects, but I grew up next to one. So I saw violence in the projects. You know, some of it was racial, some of it wasn't, but and then we moved to a different part of the city and it was better. You know, and then when I was 17, I went to the military. You know, I used to do a lot of fishing and playing down by the river and stuff, so.
Can you tell me about your military experience?
I enlisted at 17. I went through basic training in Missouri. I went through advanced individual training in Missouri. Then I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, and went to jump school and became a paratrooper. From there, I went and served with 7th Special Forces at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. While I was there, I volunteered to serve overseas and with the 1st Battalion of the 509th Airborne Battalion Combat Team in Vicenza, Italy. And then when I was in Italy, I re-enlisted to come home to Massachusetts. And I was stationed at Fort Devens with 10th Special Forces. And then I got off of jump status to work in my field, which was heavy equipment, because parachutes won't hold up a 60-ton bulldozer. And so that's when I got arrested, when I was stationed at Fort Devens. I was on active duty when I was arrested.
So were your plans to be career military for as long as you could?
Well, I was going to retire at 37. And start a second career.
I wrote down that you were 22 years old. I feel kind of creepy that I know that. Is that correct?
Lowell, Mass. Actually, I was 23 when I got arrested.
Can you tell us about the crime that you were accused of?
Actually, there was a rape on the night of November 16th by Westford Street in Lowell. And then there was an attempted rape on the night of November 17th. In the same area. And my friend had just moved to that area like a month before. So I was going over to visit him. So I stopped in a package store and got a six pack, walking over his house, and that's when they stopped me. I was just walking down the street and they pulled over and they stopped me and started questioning me. And then, you know, I gave them my driver's license. I gave him my driver's license and they ran a background check and I had no record at all. And then they searched me, you know, without no probable cause and arrested me for possession of marijuana.
So they arrest you for possession of marijuana. And how long were you in locked up for that?
Oh, it was only overnight. The next morning I went into court and was arraigned on possession and got 6 months probation. But they used that to get my picture to show to the victims. And the victims said that it was me that did the crimes. Even though the first victim said I didn't have a mustache and the second one said I did have a mustache. And even I can't grow a mustache overnight.
Okay, usually in the military, yes. Do y'all have to, do you have to shave your face? Is it some type of dress code, appearance code?
Absolutely. I could have a mustache, but I couldn't have a beard. And my hair had to be short, you know, above my ears. Which I got a haircut every 2 weeks. And so I looked clean cut. You know, I shaved every day. I didn't have a choice. You know, my mustache was always neatly trimmed.
And I thought, wow, he looks so friendly. I don't know how anybody could have accused him of anything.
Well, the way I believe it started was They said that the person who did the crime had a red hooded sweatshirt. And I had a red hooded sweatshirt that had my military unit on it that I wore all the time. And so they were probably 200 feet away from me on a stakeout, and they saw me with a red hooded sweatshirt. So they said that, you know, I fit the artist's conception. That is what I believe, and that's what I will always believe. That's what I think led them to arrest me.
So you said that they got your photo and they identified the victim identified you from the photo.
Well, the way it worked is the next morning, on the morning of November 18th, they did what's called an in-court identification, where they brought me into the courtroom, sat me on the bench. They didn't leave me in the docket. They sat me on the bench, and they brought the victim in to see if she could ID somebody. And she ID'd someone else. So the judge said they had no grounds to go forward. So they gave me 6 months probation and let me go. Now, as I was leaving the courthouse, they arrested me and charged me with the crimes that they said they had no grounds to go forward on.
Hold on. While you're there, they release you, and then they arrest you for the same crime?
Yep. Yeah, it was the judge gave me 6 months probation. They had took my military boots, so I was in stocking feet. And then as I was leaving, they arrested me and said, we're charging you with a rape and an attempted rape. And then brought me to the police station and booked me. So they had, that's why I believe the sweatshirt had more to do with it than anything else. And that, and I had a horrible lawyer.
Was it a public defender or a paid lawyer?
He was a paid lawyer, but he was a crook. He ended up getting disbarred for life. And then I found out that he got disbarred for life from my case because he went and approached my parents and asked if he could represent me. Well, he solicited him.
Can you explain to me what that means? I'm not familiar with that.
Usually you have to approach a lawyer and ask him to represent you. He went up to my parents and asked them if he could represent me, which I guess lawyers can't do. Well, in Massachusetts, they can't. I don't know if they can anywhere else.
So what was your... So you're leaving the courthouse, and then they arrest you for a crime that they said that they have no grounds to arrest you for. So what happens next? Right. So do they interrogate you? Do they... what's the next step?
Well, they interrogated me the night before. They asked me, you know, where were you on the night of November 16th? Now, this is while I'm arrested for possession. And I said, you know, I was in my CO's office. We were getting yelled at because we failed a nuclear biological chemical test. And I didn't leave the office till 10 past 5, quarter past 5. And I didn't get home till like 10 minutes or 6. And they said, you know, and the crimes happened at 5:30. So they're saying that I drove a Mercury Comet, which had a 6-cylinder engine. They said I drove 18 miles in 20 minutes and committed a rape on the way home, which is impossible because, right, you know, and with the traffic and this area is horrible at night. It is real horrible. Well, I had people come in and testify. I had people come in and testify that I was in my CO's office. And they just said, do you have that in writing? And I said, no. Even though I had people come in and testify. they just blow it off like big deal.
And these are military officials, basically.
Right. There was two sergeants who came in and testified on my behalf.
And that was, and it was disregarded, and
yeah.
Was there any?
Now you also got to remember at. Not really. You know, it basically came down just to, she said, she said I did it, and that was it. You know, they didn't do any biological testing or nothing like that.
How long was your trial?
It was a week, but it was a joke.
What do you mean by that?
Well, my lawyer was horrible. He never went to the scene of the crime. I tried to get him to represent that they broke into my car and searched my car, but he filed the motions for the wrong dates and stuff like that. It was just horrible. Even the DA who prosecuted me said he had the worst lawyer I ever saw.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well, it's... He apologized to me the day I got out, the DA who prosecuted me. I'm probably the only exoneree I know of that has gotten an apology from the actual person that prosecuted him.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the first that I've heard that, because I haven't received an apology, and everybody that we interview, no one has received an apology, but that's the first.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm probably the only one, and I'm actually friends with this DA now. He's a private attorney. Me and him have gone to speak at colleges and stuff like that. You know, we went
How
and spoke
it
together at Bart. He actually did some work that helped get me out.
The DA you know, did?
Yeah, when he was a private attorney. He had his doubts from the get-go that, you know, I was guilty.
So what were you ultimately convicted of?
Well, I was convicted of, after I was arrested for the first two crimes, I got arrested for a third crime, which happened right outside of Fort Devens. And that one, there was no evidence presented. They had a witness come in who said he knew my name because he knew an actor out in California when he was a stuntman or something like that had the same last name as me. And he said he saw me around the hotel that I was supposedly have committed a rape in, even though I didn't know where this motel was until probably 3 years ago. And that was,
so because he used to know someone with your name, your last name, you did it.
That's basically what it come down to, but it gets better. On that crime, there was a dirty cop involved because she had a second exoneree. I don't know if you've heard of Betty Ann Waters.
I've heard the name, yeah.
She was in a movie, but she put herself through school and put herself through college and became a lawyer and got her brother out. And the cop that arrested me arrested her brother and got her brother convicted. And she got kicked off the force because she tried to set up a cop. She's dead now. Well, what I actually got convicted of is a rape, an attempted rape, aggravated rape, and a bunch of other assault and batteries and stuff like that that go along with the crimes. And I was sentenced to 20 to 30 years, second degree life, which means you have to do 15 years for your eligible for parole. And then on top of that, I got a civil sentence of 1 day to natural life, which means I was committed to the Massachusetts Treatment Center as a sexually dangerous person. So they never had to release me. And where I wasn't going to admit to the crimes, I would have probably died in prison. Right. I probably would have died in prison as an innocent man.
What facility did you go to? What prison did you go to?
I was in Walpole, Concord, Gardner, and committed to the Mass Treatment Center for Sexually Dangerous People.
What was it like there?
Well, everyone there was a sex offender. You know, they were in for raping children, raping adults. And the only ones I really associated with are the ones who actually changed from who they were when they first came in to who they were when they got released, or who they are now, which is a huge change that they made. You know, they had to do a lot of work, and now they're all productive members of society. You know, they still have the label that they're sexually dangerous, you know, but, you know, it was, to me, it wasn't as bad as some of the other prisons I was in. There wasn't as much tension. Fear runs prisons. And that's what I believe, because when I first went to Walpole, which is the maximum security, you could smell the fear in the prison. I don't care what anyone says. That's what I felt, that you could smell the fear in the prison.
Did you meet anyone there that you also felt like was wrongly convicted?
One person, and that was Bernard Barron. He got proven innocent about 5 years after me. Me and him lived on the same block. I was forced to do therapy to keep my job. We were in the same therapy group, and he didn't get out through DNA. He had to get out through the other way, which was prove his innocence, you know, which he did. He died 2 years ago on my birthday, but he got to live some freedom.
So what was being in prison like for your relationships with your family?
It was tough. You know, I wouldn't let them come up on holidays because it got to be too tough. You know, them going home and me not and be able to go with them. I didn't see my sister for 19 years because she couldn't come to the prison. My parents stuck by me, but as they got older, I got to see them less and less. And then my father had a quintuple bypass, so he really couldn't drive. So then they would come up like once a month. At first, they would come up every Saturday. You know, and it was a 50 to 60 mile drive one way. And so, you know, it was tough on them. You know, my father had a chance to move to Kentucky for a better job, but he didn't go because he didn't want to leave me here. You know, I told him to go. You know, so, you know, but they stuck by me the whole time I was in prison, which a lot of people don't have that.
And you had this military career going for you. And what, I mean, did you have any kind of education or anything? I mean, I can't imagine that there's anything comparable in prison, but did you have any kind of education services offered?
There was college offered, but I really couldn't do it because you sit in a classroom and I just wasn't a person to sit around in a classroom. I was an automotive mechanic in high school. When I went into the military, I went in as a diesel mechanic. So I was working as a diesel mechanic in school, in the military. So I had to put all of that on hold, you know, while I was in prison.
That's so unfortunate.
And I'm a diesel mechanic now.
Good for you.
I work for Waste Management. I got my job there after 2 months after I got out of prison, I was hired. Because I had a plan. I had a plan. See, like I said, I had to do treatment in prison. So, part of my treatment was you had to come up with a release plan. You know, and I told my therapist, she was a social worker, well, she was going for her doctorate, and I told her, I said, listen, we'll do a release plan, but I'm not going to write it down because I may die in prison. And she says, okay. I says, I get proven innocent through DNA. I take 2 months off. I get a job. I meet a woman. We get married. We have children. The way it worked out was I got out of prison through DNA. I took 2 months off. I worked for Waste Management, where I've been for 14 years. I met my wife online. We have two children, my son Joshua and my daughter Aliza. Aliza Karen Lucy, who's named after the woman who got me out of prison.
Brooke, I know you're not married yet, but I want to make a suggestion about our new sponsor, Zola. It's a wedding registry company that's not only free and easy to use, but it's also fun and easy.
Okay, I'm listening.
One of my favorite features is that you can leave notes next to the gifts that you register for, explaining why you must have a certain item.
Wait, so I can leave a note telling my family and friends why I absolutely must have a kitchen towel with a lobster on it?
That's right. Plus, if you have your heart set on something that's kind of expensive, your guests can work together to get you the gift of your dreams.
That's genius. I'm sold. I'm not even waiting to get married. I'm going to go check out Zola right now. Wait, how do I do that again?
It's easy. To sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, go to Zola.com/actual. That's Zola.com/actual.
I'm already there, and I'm so excited. I just went to the search at the top and typed in cat, and I found the most adorable black and white cat two-piece mug set. This could be the best day ever. I just had to go to Zola.com, Zola.com/actual.
I read that you wrote to the National Innocence Project, but then were transferred to the New England Innocence Project. Is that true?
Well, I wrote to the New York Innocence Project because back then, we're talking 1993, so the New York Innocence Project was really young. And I don't think there were any other Innocence Projects. You know, there may have been the Northwestern one, but I don't know. But that was not an Innocence Project. That was more of a journalism project. And so I wrote them a letter asking for help, and they sent me back a 28-page questionnaire. And I filled that out, and they sent me back another questionnaire, and I filled that out. I guess they wanted to compare them to see if I was just, you know, telling stories or whatever. And then they started working on my case. Now, I'm sure you both know how the Innocence Project works, where students do the research, and then the lawyers get involved when there's stuff to be done. Well, students started working on my case, and they were getting the evidence has been destroyed, the evidence has been lost. And so in 1997, Barry got a lawyer in Massachusetts to file a motion for DNA testing, but it was denied without a hearing. Because in Massachusetts, anything you file after you're convicted goes in front of your sentencing judge. Well, my sentencing judge had serious issues with me because when I was found guilty, he said, "Mr. Maher, do you have anything to say? I said, "Yes, Your Honor. I think if you think this is justice, I think you and your whole judicial system are a crock of shit." You don't say that, George. You don't say that to a judge.
Right.
So he sentenced me to 20 to 30 years. And then I found out afterwards that from the DA that he was going to give me a 10 to 15. He goes, "But I said that." And he whispered to the clerk, he goes, have you signed that yet? He goes, "No." He goes, "Double it." So that's how I ended up with a 20 to 30.
So wait, all of your motions after that had to go before that same guy who was obviously biased against you? Wow.
Everything I ever filed was filed in front of him. And then so I was devastated at the time. And so out of the blue, a reporter from the Boston Globe named John Element came and interviewed me. Well, he wrote me a letter asking if he could interview me about DNA. And I said, okay, you know, this is a branch of hope. You know, they don't come down all that often when you're in prison.
Right.
You know, so he came down and he interviewed me. He interviewed me for probably 2.5 hours. And finally I said to him, I said, who sent you? And he goes, oh, you know who sent me. I says, I don't have a clue who sent you. He said, well, I was in Suffolk County Courthouse and I saw J.W. Carney, who is the DA that prosecuted me back in 84. You know, and I asked him, I said, he was a private attorney now. He says, Jay, you know, let me do an article on one of the crazies that you've represented. Cause he represented a guy who blew up an abortion clinic. He shot up an abortion clinic and another guy who killed his wife and brought his kids down so they could see. And recently he represented Whitey Bulger, which I don't know if you know who that is, but he was one of the big gangsters up here. And he said, so I asked him and I says, you know, he goes, I'll tell you what. If what I think is true, and if you do go and write the article on this guy, you may get a Pulitzer Prize. He says, go see Dennis Mayer and talk to him. Well, he didn't do the article on me. He did it on Benjamin Laguerre, who came back with a DNA match, which is a whole other can of worms. And Ulysses Rodriguez Charles, who was proven innocent through DNA. But before he left, he said, your judge is retiring in June. So the day he retired, I called the New York Innocence Project. And they told me that, they says, well, what you need to do is contact the New England Innocence Project. So I did that. And that's how I went with the New England Innocence Project. That's how I met Aliza Kaplan, who got me out. We may have met her at the conferences. And Karen Burns, who was the student who worked on my case.
Yeah, I read that a student saved the day.
Yep. They were looking for evidence, and she was frustrated. You know, she kept getting told, the evidence is destroyed, the evidence has been lost. But she was persistent. And so she went looking for help, and she went knocking on doors asking for help. And this person went down and looked for evidence on their lunch hour. And they found the evidence that they said had been lost or destroyed. And that's where the DNA testing came from, because she found the evidence.
That's amazing.
In the Lowell case. And then that got me out through the Lowell case. And then all of a sudden, you know, Martha Coakley, who was the DA at the time, called Aliza and asked if she wanted to make a deal, and they would give me time served and, you know, let me out. And Aliza didn't even ask me. She said, no. She said, we're not going to do that.
Love it.
She says, we're going to prove that he's innocent. And like 2 weeks later, a slide shows up on the DA's desk from my case. The slides from the rape kit. And so they DNA tested that and came back with two different DNAs, and neither one of them was mine. So then I called Aliza on April 1st, and she says, when do you want to go home? You know, it's April Fool's Day. Well, that was heavy duty. You know, and of course I started crying, and I says, well, it was a Tuesday, and I said, well, you better make it Thursday, because my parents need a day, at least a day, to deal with this.
Yeah.
And then my father had a leukemia treatment the day that I told him. And so the next day was usually his bad day. So he ended up doing interviews all day long with all the TV stations, because they knew I was getting out.
Those chemicals take a toll on the body.
Yeah. He died like 2 years after I got out.
I'm sorry.
You know, he got to see his grandson, which he was ecstatic over that. You know, and he knew that he was going to have another granddaughter before he died.
Did you have any kids before you went in?
No. No, I was in the military. I was having too much time partying and having a good time. Yeah, I was more focused on serving my country and than anything else.
You know, I've never met or heard about someone in the military being convicted. They'll let you know that wrongful conviction, they do happen. They can happen to anybody.
I think Kevin Green was on active duty when he was wrongfully convicted, too. He was a Marine.
He was. I do another podcast for A&E, and I just did a story about him.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were exonerated, did your military benefits kick in, or did you get, I can't understand how you would be punished for being wrongly convicted by the military. Do you know what I mean?
Well, when I was convicted, I was given a discharge under other than honorable condition and thrown out of the military. So when I get out, I went down and I saw my representative and a congressman, Marty Meehan, helped me get my discharge, my court-martial reversed, and get honorably discharged and get 2.5 years back pay, which wasn't a whole lot of money then. I made like $12,000 a year in the military. But he got me, they were the first ones who did the right thing. They reversed my court-martial, honorably discharged me. Well, I didn't have enough time in the military to retire, but they did the right thing.
That's amazing, because I've heard of people who've been exonerated and, you know, they're ready to retire, but they haven't had the opportunity to pay into Social Security, so they can't collect that. But the fact that the military reversed that and is helping you, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. They did an awesome job. You know, I have no problems with the military.
What was your exoneration date?
April 3rd, 2003. It's the day I walked out the door. That's the day I got my apology from the DA that prosecuted me.
DeMarco, I think you have a problem. Every time we talk, you tell me about the new Thunder game you went to. You must spend so much time and money getting tickets.
No way. No way. I had a SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few clicks, the Thunder tickets are mine in a flash. And I get to watch the Thunder play.
I'm not a huge sports fan, but I know how much you love the SeatGeek app, so I decided to try it. And I'm stoked. I discovered one of my favorite musicals is coming to my city. I was so amazed at how easy it was to find a seat in my budget.
Plus, did you know every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with no worries?
That's incredible. I know SeatGeek is going to be my top app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. It should be yours too.
Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase.
Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code ACTUAL today.
Now, how was adjusting? You know, you've been out quite, you know, for 14 years now. How was that adjustment?
Well, it was tough because when I went in, you figure there was no computers. The first thing I got out, my parents bought a computer for me. I went on there and got buried in porn. So I didn't know how to get out of there, and I shut the computer off. You know, but, you know, then you had to adjust to walking on the street, you know, hearing cars go by, crossing a street, being able to look another person in the eye and not getting ridiculed for it because, you know, some of the guards in prison would say, well, what are you looking at her for? What are you looking at him for? You know, because, you know, and being able to do that. But I was walking down the street, and a guy comes over and he says, you're him. You're that guy. You know, and I says, what are you talking about? He says, He said, you were just proven innocent. I says, yeah, I was. He goes, I'm so sorry. I says, well, you didn't do anything wrong. He goes, that doesn't matter. He goes, I'm still sorry for what happened. You know, which that was really overwhelming. You know, and because this is just a person off the street.
Yes.
You know, and then I went to get my driver's license, and you know, I gave her my prison ID. It's all I had. And she says, you know, your license has been suspended. I says, for what? She says, you had a speeding ticket 10 years ago. I says, well, I got out of prison yesterday after 19 years. I think it's slightly impossible. And she goes, let me get my boss. You know, and they went and straightened it all out, you know, and then they gave me my permit test on a piece of paper and a pen. I think I answered 5 questions, and she took it out of my hand. She said, you got your permit. She goes, you want to take your driver's test? I said, whoa. I says, I just got out of prison yesterday. I think I need to drive some. You know, and then so the next week I went for my driver's test, and I get in the car, and, you know, I told the state trooper, he goes, I know who you are. He goes, I just want to know who's going to play you in the movies. And I said, oh, wonderful. You know, but basically he had me drive around the block and do a 3-point turn and parallel park with no cars on the street. You know, so that was good. You know, I've had a lot of good experiences with people in authority positions. So, you know, I know not everyone has. You know, but like I said, I took the 2 months off so that I could adjust to being free. You know, I probably did.
Counseling?
No, I had a lot of counseling in prison.
Okay. You didn't need to get any when you got out?
You know, if I needed it, I had therapists I could call. Mm-hmm. You know, so, but I never felt that I needed it.
Yeah. Have you ever had a breakdown?
No.
I've heard guys say that they have breakdowns, you know, after being in for so long. I haven't had one either yet.
Some of them have, you know, some of them have had really hard times. You know, I know a few who have had really hard times, you know, and they're still having hard times now, and they've been out longer than I have. You know, but I look at it as I let go of all the anger.
Good for you.
Because the anger will just eat you. And make you an angry, bitter person. And I figured, you know, if I can't get the things in life that I want, I can't get them if I'm an angry, bitter person. So I let it all go. You know, just said, well, I'll put this all behind me and start fresh. You know, I got lucky. I did 2 job interviews, and I ended up getting both jobs. The second interview, I walked in and I said to the guy, I says, you know, I come down for an interview. I says, I just got out of prison 2 months ago after 19 years, 2 months and 29 days, and I want to fix your trucks. He goes, are you a terrorist? You know, okay. So you figure this is what, 16 months after 9/11 or 18 months after 9/11 or something like that. And where I was going to work, they did everything in Boston. You know, they did all Boston Garden and all the tunnel. They would go through all the tunnels and stuff. You know, and these trucks can carry 15, 20 tons of trash. You know, and so I didn't get offended. You know, I just told him, I says, no. And then we talked, and he says, I'll tell you what, I'll take a chance. And I've been there ever since.
You must like it.
You know, but I was a mechanic before I went to prison. Mm-hmm. And so I had a skill to fall back on. Whereas I know a lot of exonerees who have no skills. You know, because they went into prison. Or no, they went into prison when they were young and never had a chance to get them. Like there's a guy who got out, I think he's been out a little over a month, and he did 37 years. He went to prison when he was 17 years old.
I've talked to men, though, too, who had a skill, but that skill isn't needed anymore because it's been replaced by a computer or a machine or things like that.
Well, I know mine is won't get replaced because you need to turn a wrench.
Yep, exactly. What advice would you give to someone who has found themselves in your position that was wrongly convicted or is being wrongly accused of a crime that they didn't commit?
Someone who's wrongly accused, I don't know what I would tell them. You know, but someone who was wrongly convicted, I would say one of the best things you can do is let go of the anger. Just because they're not going to give you anything back that you lost. You have to fight for everything that you get. And if you're an angry person, it's probably not going to happen. Because if you let go of the anger, then you let go of the anger, then you can focus on the things in life that you want or the things in life that you need.
That's great advice.
You know, because if you see a lot of the exonerees who are having a hard time, some of them can't let go of the anger because they think that they owe them for what they did to you. They may owe you for what they did to you, but they're not going to admit it. The government they convicted you. Get over it. That's basically what they're thinking. You know, it's wrong, but that's a lot of the times of what they're thinking. You know,
and in most cases, it's probably best to just, you know, get over it.
Absolutely.
The anger ain't going to do nothing but hold you back from accomplishing goals and dreams.
Absolutely. You know, I had dreams, you know, I was hoped to be married, have children. You know, I'm married, I have children, I have a big house, I have a nice car, you know, but I've worked for it all. You know, I do a lot of public speaking. You know, I've been out 14 years, I've probably spoken 400 times. You know,
I have a question. You know, I've been speaking to kids at the elementary and high school, and I'm still fresh. You know, I've had like 8 speaking engagements. You know, what advice can you give me?
Well, one of the best things you can do just speak natural. Don't write everything down. You know, just speak from the heart. You know, tell them this happened to me. You know, I was the one who was wrongly convicted, because some of the people who speak from the third person. You know, this happened. Well, when I was walking down the street, the police arrested me. You know, they stopped me and they started questioning me. You know, sometimes I get emotional. Sometimes I cry when I speak, you know, but it's real. And if I'm speaking to students, the way I always close is I tell them, you know, you are the future of this country. You are the ones who are going to change the laws, change the way that, you know, things are done, even though a lot of stuff has already changed, like, you know, witness identification. But tell them that they're the future. You know, you may go on to become politicians, doctors, lawyers, judges. Who knows, maybe one of you will become a president. You know, and it sort of kind of empowers them after you're done speaking. I mean, one of the first times I spoke to a high school. Them kids got so fired up, they wrote a bunch of letters to the state house saying, you know, you got to give this guy compensation and all this other stuff. So, you know, they really listen to you. If you're speaking from the heart and you're telling them like it was for you, they hear it and they feel it.
Okay, you know, I've had, thank you for that advice. I appreciate it.
You know, I've had a whole half a class crying because of the way I was speaking and because of what happened to me. You know, I've spoken to... Go ahead.
No, the reason I'm thanking you is because, you know, I've been up there, and it's been times where I wanted to, you know, I was emotional, I wanted to cry, but I really held him in and, you know, want a tear come in, but, you know, let it go. Is that what you
said? Yeah, and... Yeah, if you're going to cry, just, you know, take a second, you know, get your shit back together, because sometimes it is overwhelming. You know, and you're speaking about what happened to you, and you're telling it from your perspective, not in a third party or anything like that. You know, it's really what happened to you. You know, I do a lot of stuff with the New England Innocence Project. You know, I testified, I do stuff with New York too. And I've testified in a lot of places, and they come and get me because I get emotional. You know, I had senators crying when I was speaking in front of them, you know, to pass different types of legislation. And it works. Because then they're not hearing from a lawyer. They're hearing from the person that it happened to. You know, this is me. I'm not a book. This is who I am, and this is what I'm about now. You know, because I want to share what happened to... I want to share what happened to me with you so that it doesn't happen to someone else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you'd be surprised the reaction, you know. You know, I'm glad you're speaking, you know, because I think all exonerees should speak. You know, some of us can, some of us can't. But if you can, do it. And always ask for an honorarium.
You know, and I don't feel like I can do it, but I get up there and I do it. I'm, you know, I'm nervous, I'm sweaty, but, you know, this is what happened. And I feel like we should pay it forward.
Absolutely. Because there's a lot of colleges where I live like 25 miles north of Boston. There are so many colleges in Boston, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've spoken at probably half of them, and I get called all the time. Can you come speak? Can you come speak? Can you come speak? We're doing this speaking for justice thing. Can you come speak at it? You know, I went and spoke at a high school. And the next week, I got the other high school in that town asked me to come speak.
Do you get paid to speak?
You know, I've made as much as $5,000 on one speaking engagement.
Oh, wow.
That's why I said, you always ask if there's an honorarium.
I think that's so important, because some people think that just because you're helping that you don't want to get paid, but your time is valuable. You know the value of time better than a lot of us. So absolutely get compensated for your time.
And you'll find out that a lot of the places have honorariums. Okay. You know, the one I get paid the most at was a college in Connecticut. You know, they said, yeah, we're going to give you $5,000. I says, who's that go to? They go, to you. I said, we just want you to come down and speak, and we'll give you $5,000. I said, okay. Don't have to tell me twice.
So have you been...
You know, but I also... Yes, I have. Massachusetts passed a compensation bill 2 years after I got out. They're trying to update it now to make it better. And I've helped in that process. You know, I tell them, I says, if you need me, just call me. You know, I was one of the first three in Massachusetts to be compensated. You know, I got $500,000 tax-free. And that's, if you get compensated, it's all tax-free. Don't believe them if they tell you you got to pay taxes on it. Tell them, no, I don't. Because it's from a wrongful conviction. You know, but I've also settled lawsuits, too. I didn't get as much as I wanted, but I didn't get as much as a lot of other people got, but I settled lawsuits. You know, I'm good with what I got, you know. But, you know, which state are you in?
I'm in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Well, you were the last state to pass DNA testing. Massachusetts was the 49th. That's the only reason I know. Yeah.
Are you going to the Memphis Innocence Conference next year?
I sure hope so. I missed the last two.
Too.
I've been to 10 of them. I went to Orlando.
What's your next speaking engagement? Is it anytime soon?
January is my next one. That's at in Salem. Now, if you go to Boston College, the website, they have me speaking there. Because I'm on, if you go to the Boston College Law School, that's where I spoke. I'm on the front page of their magazine. And then that shows me speaking. But I think there's a couple online that have me speaking too.
So if people wanted to contact you, like to hire you to speak, are you open to that or?
Absolutely. No, I'm always open to speaking.
How would they do that?
Usually they go to the Innocence Project. Or they can send me an email. You have my email address. No, because I have a couple of speaking engagements I do every year. I speak at a law firm that got me my settlement. They pay me $1,000 to come in and speak for probably 40 minutes to their summer interns. And I've been doing that for 14 years. She goes, Dennis has been coming here 14 years, and I've cried every time he's come.
What do you think that people, just regular people like me, who aren't attorneys but want to help, can do?
See if you can set up something for helping an exoneree to get back into society. You know, like a reentry program. You don't have to be a lawyer to do that. You know, it can be a grassroots thing, or volunteer if there's an innocence project in your state or in your area. You know, because they always need help. You know, even if it's just have a fundraiser for the Innocence Project, or have it a fundraiser for a new exoneree. You know, those are the, because it wasn't easy when I first got out. You know, you had to make a lot of adjustments, and you have to start feeling comfortable with what you're doing, and you know, figure out, you know, I can do this. You know, if I can help another person be exonerated, then that's what makes it worth it. You know, I helped pass a DNA law in Vermont, and it got a guy out. You know, so that made it so much worth it. His name was John Greger. And because I went up and testified, they passed the DNA law, and he got DNA testing, and they proved him innocent.
I love that you're such a huge advocate, because you could have just went away after you were exonerated, but you didn't. You speak and you advocate and you push for people who had the same unfortunate predicament that you did, and I think that that's amazing. So I just wanted to tell you I really admire that.
Thank you. You know, it's my way of giving back for what was done for me. You know, I got lucky. You know, and they found the evidence. You know, how many cases don't they find evidence in? You know, how many times do they they're not able to help somebody? Not because they don't want to, but it's because they can't.
No, I'm inspired. You know, I didn't realize that you did so much, you know. And, you know, that's inspiring for me because, you know, I want to help people too, you know, that. Because people gave me a chance, a second chance in life. So, I'm just continue doing what you're doing. I'm just happy that you're doing it.
Well, thank you.
It's motivation.
Well, I do it because, like I said, I've been involved with the Innocence Project for a long time, 24 years. That's when I first started with the Innocence Project. As the woman who was the director here, because our Innocence Project had to be downgraded because we didn't have money, and she says, well, if I need you, I'll just call. She says, if I need you, I'll just call you. Don't worry. I says, I know. But I do, like, we have fundraisers where one of the attorneys will have a fundraiser at another law firm and invite lawyers. And he'll ask me, he goes, Dennis, can you come speak? I said, of course I can. I says, you don't even need to ask. Just tell me where to go. That one, I don't ask for money. I don't ask for an honorarium because it's for the Innocence Project. And there's more about it. It's what it's for.
So I'm so glad that we talked to Dennis. He's so inspirational. And I'm glad you asked that question about speaking engagements and how you get involved in that. I think it's really important.
No, he gave me some huge advice, and I'm going to take advantage of that. And I have to do some studying and find out some things that I believe that will help better my speaking ability and myself and getting compensated for my speaking.
So until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. Sound production was done by Blake Maples, who also created the original music for Actual Innocence. You can see more of his work at blakemaples.com.